Well, thanks so much for the invitation to speak to you today. It's a privilege. I have heard of the Preston Road Church all of my adult life, especially when I was in full-time ministry. Not having the opportunity to be here, it's a privilege to be here before you today. Thank you. When my adult children were much younger, some of their favorite books were the Little House series by Laura Ingalls Wilder. I'm sure you remember the television show, Little House on the Prairie. That was based on the second book in the series. The first book in the series is called Little House in the Big Woods. It tells the story of Laura's family in Wisconsin before they moved to the prairie. And here's an excerpt from that book. One morning, Paul went away before daylight with the horses and a wagon, and that night he came home with a wagon load of fish. The big wagon box was piled full, and some of the fish were as big as Laura. Paul had gone to Lake Pepin and caught them all with a net. Ma cut large slices of flaky white fish without one bone for Laura and Mary. They all feasted on the good, fresh fish. It was so tasty. Laura wished they could eat it all. But most of the fish must be salted down in barrels for the winter. For winter was coming. The days were shorter, and frost crawled up the window panes at night. Soon the snow would come. Then the log house would be almost buried in snowdrifts, and the lake and the streams would freeze. In the bitter cold weather, Paul could not be sure of finding any food to eat. So as much food as possible must be stored away in the little house before winter came. Now I share that story to remind some of us and enlighten the rest of us that refrigerators and freezers have not always been around. Keeping meat and vegetables fresh, it's so easy today, we take it for granted, but that was not always so. Not that many years ago, keeping vegetables fresh could be done if stored in a cool, dry place for a short period of time. But keeping meat and fish fresh for any length of time, it had to be salted down. There was no way to preserve meat for any length of time without salt. But when properly cured with salt, meat can last a long time. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus used this practice of curing meat with salt to teach us one of our purposes as believers, and that purpose is this. We're to be salt to an unbelieving world. That purpose is desperately needed by the world because without salt, the world will rot. Let's take another look at Matthew 5:13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. Now, the more I study the teachings of Jesus, the more I am impressed that he was the master of using day-to-day experiences to teach spiritual truths. And that's the case here. When he said, "You are the salt of the earth," he was referring to a common practice in Palestine. Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount near the Sea of Galilee, and the traditional site of the sermon overlooks the sea. And for those who lived around the sea, fish was a big part of their diet. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, as you'll recall, were commercial fishermen. And so when they brought in a catch of fish, some of it would be sold in the marketplace fresh that same day. But the rest of the fish would have to be salted down if it was to be preserved for any length of time. My wife, Lynn, is a writer, and as she was researching her first book, she learned that there was a very big commercial industry around the Sea of Galilee involving the fish caught. The fish was caught, and then it would be, what was not sold fresh, would be salted down and packed into barrels and then shipped all over the Roman Empire. Now, without salt, that industry could not exist, nor could any preservation of meat or fish in that day. Salt was thus an extremely valuable commodity in the ancient world, and the practice of salting meat was known to all. So when Jesus used this word salt in the sermon, I'm persuaded that he was talking about preserving meat with salt. Not so much about flavoring, although that was maybe loosely connected, but more about preserving meat and fish with salt. And so when he said to the disciples, "You are the salt of the earth," they would have understood him to be talking about preserving meat with salt. If he'd said that today, he could have been, "You're the refrigerator of the world. You're the freezer of the world. You're the Yeti of the world." But those don't really catch the flavor as much as what Jesus says, "You're the salt of the earth." And so now that we understand the analogy, what does it mean? Let's break it down into three parts. First, when Jesus used the word earth here, he was not talking about planet earth so much as he was talking about people on earth. He was referring to human culture or society on earth. Now, there are many levels of human society or culture on earth. There's Western culture and Eastern culture. There's American culture. There's Dallas culture. There's the culture at school, the culture at work, the culture when we're with our friends. There's the culture that exists within our families. What we mean by the word culture here is how people behave with each other when they're together, the rules that they follow, whether spoken or unspoken, how they get along, the standards that exist. It's all wrapped up in Jesus' use of the word earth here. And now by using the word earth with the word salt, Jesus tells us something about all levels of human culture. Unless there's some kind of preserving influence, human culture like meat or fish will spoil. It will rot. Here's an example of fish without salt. Rotting fish. It does not look very appetizing, does it? Unfortunately, we cannot smell it. That's what happens to human culture without a preserving influence. Morally, spiritually, religiously, a culture will decay. The way the human beings treat each other will deteriorate. The community will become rotten, just like spoiled fish. Here's a case in point. In 1880, the successful attorney and avowed agnostic, George Walzer, bought 2,000 acres of land in Missouri to start a unique town. It would be a town without a church, where unbelievers could bring up their children without religious training and where Christians were not allowed. Advertisements for the town bragged that it was the only town of its size in the United States without a priest, preacher, church, saloon, God, Jesus, hell, or devil. The town was established. About 300 people moved to the town, and at first it did okay. Some Christians moved there too, seeing the town as a fertile mission field, to their credit. But Walzer would have none of that. He forced the Christians out of town. And then when some of those Christians bought land adjacent to the town, he built a barbed wire fence to keep Christians out of his God-free town. 5 years after the town was established, most of the people who moved there were ready to leave. But they could not sell their homes. A visitor to the town in 1885 described it like this: "The boast about the sobriety of the town is false. More drunken infidels can be seen in a year in the town than drunken Christians among 100 times as many church members during the same time. Swearing, or profanity, is the common form of speech in the town, and nearly every inhabitant, young and old, swears habitually. Girls and boys swear on the streets, playground, and at home. Fully half of the females swear, and a large number swear habitually. Lack of reverence for parents and lack of obedience to them is the rule. There are more people living together who have former companions living than in any other town of 10 times the population. A good portion of the few books that are read are of the class that decency keeps under lock and key. In no town is slander more prevalent or the charges more vile. If one were to accept what the inhabitants say about each other, he would conclude that there is a hell, including everyone in town, and that its inhabitants are the devils." It took only a few short years for the town's unattractiveness and inconsistency to be exposed, Only 5 years after its establishment, 9/10 of those now in town would leave if they could sell their property. More wealth has been lost by locating in the town than has been made in it. Hundreds have been deceived and injured and ruined financially. After that experiment failed, the town started asking churches to come and establish themselves. Surprisingly, the town still exists, about 800 residents, and is full of churches. As that story illustrates, without a preserving influence, human culture will rot. It will spoil. Or to use the metaphor of Jesus, without salt, the world will rot. And that brings us to the second point from this statement by Jesus. Christians are to be the salt that stops the world's rot. We are to be the preserving influence upon our culture that prevents evil from taking over. Or to put it another way, by the lives we live, we are to make the world a better place for all. How does this work? Consider this. Unlike refrigerators or freezers or ice chests, to be a preserving influence, salt has to be rubbed into the meat. We're not talking here about a salt shaker sprinkled over the meat. It takes lots of salt, and that salt has to be applied to the meat, rubbed into the meat for it to work. For example, I found this website that was explaining about how to cure ham, salt-cured ham. And so it described the steps. First, you clean the piece of meat that you want to cure, the ham. You cut slits in it at strategic places, and then you lay it in a bed of salt, and then you take handfuls of salt and rub it in and pack it into the slits that you've made and rub it in to all of the exposed areas of the meat as much as you possibly can. We're talking about volumes of salt that's rubbed in and applied there. And then when you're finished, you've got something that looks kind of like this. This salt is just covered. It's just packed in. There's no part of it that has been left untouched by the salt. So that's the image that we need to have in mind when we think about what Jesus says about being the salt of the earth. You know, sometimes when we think about the teachings of Jesus and how countercultural they are, it's tempting to say, well, we've just got to move away. We've got to separate ourselves completely from the culture that we live in because it is so difficult to live as a disciple of Jesus here. But Jesus says, no, that's not what you're called to be and not what you're called to do. Not called to hide away, but to be present in society and culture and to be that preserving influence, which means that you're rubbing the influence of Jesus in as many places you possibly can so that it does truly become a preserving influence. 2 years ago, I had the privilege of completing my doctorate and receiving my degree from SMU. Better late than never, I always say. As part of my dissertation, I wrote a chapter on the history of the virtue of charity in the world, or what we think of as when we think of loving care for others. And today, that idea of charity is so common. Of course we should help those in need. Of course we should help those who are suffering. And so we have this plethora of institutions and organizations that exist to help those in need and care for people that need our help. But that impetus, that cultural society impetus, has not always been present in culture. For example, consider the ancient Greco-Roman world. It was a hard and mean place to live. There were no hospitals, no orphanages, no government assistance, no stimulus checks, no soup kitchens, and no other institutions to help those in need. If you were hungry, you starved. If you needed medical care and didn't have the money to pay the doctor, you did not receive medical care. And of course, friends and family would help as they could, but poverty was widespread. And that sort of help was minimal at best. the widespread ethical impulse that's so present in our culture, think Red Cross, for example, simply did not exist in that culture. But with the arrival of Christianity, things begin to change. Disciples of Jesus, motivated by the command of Jesus to love one another, begin to care for the poor and ill, first among their own, but then outside of their own. One historian writes, "Owing to a combination of inner motivation, discipline, and effective leadership, the local Christian congregation created in the first two centuries of its existence an organization that was unique in the classical world, in effectively and systematically caring for its members who were suffering." There existed in the classical world no external impulse, no elevated ideal, no specific virtue of compassion. That ideal had to await the coming of Christianity. Later, in the fourth century, building on the foundation of Christian charity, Basil the Great established the first hospital in history. It was in Caesarea, which is modern-day Turkey. Actually, it was more than a hospital. It was a complex of caring. At the center of the complex was a church, and around it were structures including guest houses, hotels, schools, orphanages, homes for the poor, and the hospital itself. This complex was called the Basileid. Another historian describes Basil. With his sermons, Basil encouraged the wealthy to support his social projects for the poor. His work has been called a major social revolution that challenged directly the corruption and uncontrolled self-interest of 4th century Caesarea. And this revolution, which included the world's first hospital, was based on a Christian understanding of charity, of sharing one's wealth with the poor, particularly during times of crisis. And so following Basil's lead, other Christian hospitals were built across the Roman Empire. And as a result, historians have argued that the hospital was, in origin and conception, a distinctly Christian institution. The point of this history lesson is clear. Due to their commitment to charity, disciples of Jesus became the salt that stopped the world's rot. The world became a better place to live, thanks to the church. Some other ways we can be salt. If we're with someone in a group and they begin to slander another person, we can ask them to stop. We don't have to do it arrogantly. We can ask them to stop, or we can leave. And somehow in a kind way and yet an effective way, we can communicate that that's not acceptable. Or if you're with someone else and they begin to use profanity or swear or racial slurs, we can ask them not to do so. Or we can step away. Again, we don't have to be arrogant about it. We can do it courageously. And when we do even little things like that, we're applying salt to the rot. The point is that in every way we can, we're obligated by Jesus to be salt to a decaying culture, to stop the rot that threatens human happiness and well-being. And this brings us to our third point made by Jesus in this image. Again, verse 13, "You're the salt of the earth, but if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men." Now, what does Jesus mean when he says, "If salt loses its saltiness"? As some of you may know, salt is a stable compound. It cannot lose its saltiness. But salt can be contaminated. And most likely Jesus is speaking here of salt that has become contaminated by other substances. If dirt or something else is mixed in with the salt may still be present, but the salt is useless and there's nothing to do with it but throw it out. It's worthless as salt. Here's a picture of salt being mixed with sand. Now, how many of you would put the cup with the mix of salt and sand? How many would take that to flavor your lunch today? None of you. Because even though it does have salt in it, and even though the salt is still there, it has been contaminated. It's no good for being a flavoring or preserving influence anymore. Salt that is impure is worthless. Only pure salt will stop the rot. And I hope the application here is obvious as well. We are to do all we can to stop or at least slow the rot. That's our calling, but if we allow ourselves to be polluted by the world, if we allow sin in our lives, then our efforts will be futile. Only salt that is pure will slow the rot and stop it. And the judgment Jesus places on salt that has become impure, it's no longer good for anything except be thrown out and trampled by men. I can't think of a more powerful image here of Jesus that calls on us to keep our lives pure and free from sin in order to be the salt that the world desperately needs. I was deeply saddened last year when the story came out about a well-known Christian apologist, had a worldwide ministry, but after he died at the end of last year, the stories began to come out he had abused women wherever he went around the world, and those stories began to come forth, and as a result, tragically, his legacy, his reputation, his witness destroyed. And not just his and his ministries, but Christianity itself took a huge hit because of that. Only pure salt will stop the rot. So let's not end there. Let's go back and think about the hospital tradition and how that has impacted the world for good, and how so many have been blessed, and how the world has been made a better place because some Christians many years ago decided to be the salt to stop the rot. Let's stand and sing.